So this evening, we come to the 13th chapter of The Life Divine. It was released in, of course, the journal Arya, the Philosophic Review, on his birthday in 1915. Before the pages of The Life began, Life Divine began, though, he had a statement that he wanted to make. He titled it Our Ideal. I think reading the first paragraph at least would help set the context of what Sri Aurobindo was trying to achieve in this journal. Our Ideal. The Arya, having completed its first year and survived the first perils of infancy, now offers itself a second time to the decisions of time and the mind of the hour. We think it necessary to open our new year with a succinct statement of the idea this review is intended to serve and the aim which it holds before it. For our review has been conceived neither as a mirror of the fleeting interests and surface thoughts of the period we live in, nor as the mouthpiece of a sect, school, or already organized way of thinking. Its object is to feel out for the thought of the future, to help in shaping its foundations, and to link it to the best and most vital thought of the past. He continues, we believe in the constant progression of humanity, and we hold that that progression is the working out of a thought in life which sometimes manifests itself on the surface and sometimes sinks below and works behind the mask of external forces and interests. I think we'll find that directly relevant to our topic tonight. So, The Life Divine. The chapter is entitled The Divine Maya. And as always, he opens with a couple of mottos, citations from the Veda and the Vedanta. In this case, both come from the Rig Veda. The translation that he offers of the first here, by the names of the Lord and hers, they shaped and measured the force of the Mother of Light, wearing might after might of that force as a robe. The lords of Maya shaped out form in this being. That was from the third mandala, the 38th sukta, and the 7th verse of that. The next, the masters of Maya shaped all by his Maya. The fathers who have divine vision set him within as a child that is to be born. I think you'd be interested to know that this is one of those chapters early in the book that Sri Aurobindo has gone back and touched up here and there. And in fact, he has translated again both of these verses from the original. Here's the original as it appeared in the Arya. By his names, they shaped and measured the power of the Supreme Consciousness. Wearing might after might of force as a robe, the lords of Maya shaped out form in this being. So, the power of the Supreme Consciousness has become the force of the Mother of Light. The second, the masters of forming knowledge made a shape of him by his knowledge that comprehends and forms. The fathers set him within as a child that is to be born. So, The masters of forming knowledge have become directly the masters of Maya. Maya Vinaha. The fathers, Pitara. And wearing might after might of that force, Asuryam, those who have great power. Of course, we know that in the Puranas, the Asuras become agents of darkness and division. Great forces, no doubt. But here, early in the Veda, they are still those beings which, in a sense, act at the urging of the divine to accomplish great deeds. They have great power. Maybe they'll recall their better days. So the power of the Supreme Consciousness becomes the Mother of Light. And of course, the idea of the Mahashakti, of the Divine Mother, grows more and more powerful in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy with the gathering decades. Of course, when Mira Richard returns from Japan to India in 1920, within half a dozen years, she is regarded as the very moving force of that incarnate motherhood, if you will. So perhaps that has its own impact upon the shaping of this translation. But the idea of Maya, of that which measures out what is infinite into what is finite, is key to this entire chapter. It is the idea behind this chapter. So let's begin it. Existence that acts and creates by the power and from the pure delight of its conscious being is the reality that we are. The self of all our modes and moods, the cause, object, and goal of all our doing, becoming, and creating. As the poet, artist, or musician, when he creates, does really nothing but develop some potentiality in his unmanifested self into a form of manifestation, and as the thinker, statesman, mechanist, only bring out into a shape of things, that which lay hidden in themselves, was themselves, is still themselves when it is cast into form, so is it with the world and the eternal. So he begins with a strong statement about the Vedantic Satchidananda. And this is a Vedanta which is Upanishadic in character. But he adds this key note that, by suggestion, existence, consciousness, bliss, is not simply a static reality, supernal and beyond the world, but has power innate within it, and so moves forth creatively to manifest and establish the universe and the laws that govern it. And again, he draws upon this aesthetic model, which of course has been popular in theology for centuries, that God is an artist. God creates as a potter on his wheel creates something. With this difference, though, this Godhead, which Sri Aurobindo recognizes, is not external to the world. It is the world itself. So this is a conceptive creation. The divine conceives and establishes, conceives and manifests. All creation, he says, or becoming, is nothing but this self-manifestation. Out of the seed, there evolves that which is already in the seed, pre-existent in being, predestined in its will to become, prearranged in the delight of becoming. So, in a sense, the end is present in the beginning. And the beginning is present before time. this is an idea which in Indian thinking is called Sat Karyavada, the idea that the effect is latent or potential in the cause. And the cause is the urge of the divine to move out, to manifest. Not happy in only one room of its being, it comes out to wander through the mansion of its entirety. And in so doing, the universe comes into being. So, if the effect is in the cause, then that means that the universe pre-exists. And if it is launched into being, then the divine has conceived and willed that it be so. And since the divine's only experience ultimately is of delight, then delight must be its destination. The universe cannot but deliver delight to those who are awakened to its secret meaning. So, the original plasm, he writes, held in itself, in force of being, the resultant organism. Now we see that. We plant a seed, the seed grows into a tree. A germ develops into a being. For it is always that secret, burdened, self-knowing force which labors under its own irresistible impulse to manifest the form of itself with which it is charged. So remember, Satchitananda is not just Sat. It is Chit, and in Chit is Chit Tapas. Sat is existence, Chit is consciousness. Chit Tapas is conscious force of existence. So it is a self-knowing force which even when it manifests itself has an insistence about what it will achieve in the form presented. The transcending and universal force insists that so-and-so happen. So the individual, pocketed only in that experience of individuality, may not see it. But the secret reality behind knows full well what it is attempting to achieve in this particular being, this movement of the becoming. So, for us to understand, we have to stand under things, yes? We have to grasp the context. He continues, only the individual who creates or develops out of himself makes a distinction between himself, the force that works in him, and the material in which he works. In reality, the force is himself. The individualized consciousness which it instrumentalizes is himself. The material which it uses is himself. The resultant form is himself. In other words, it is one existence, one force, one delight of being which concentrates itself at various points, says of each, this is I, and works in it by a various play of self-force for a various play of self-formation. So, the force is in motion. Sat says, this is I. Chit Tapas works, and the play of self-force is the element of delight. Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, again and again. This is fundamental to the experience of reality as a whole, and is also fundamental to Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. What about this Satchitananda? He says, what it produces is itself and can be nothing other than itself. It is working out a play, a rhythm, a development of its own existence, force of consciousness and delight of being. So it's an existence whose willed play is a seeking of delight. The object of the play is to gain delight. And always it is playing within itself. And the play is deliberate. It's not accidental. The universe does not arise willy-nilly. It's not inexplicable. It is inexplicable to the mind, not to the vast consciousness of the infinite. Therefore, whatever comes into the world seeks nothing but this, to be, to arrive at the intended form, to enlarge its self-existence in that form, to develop, manifest, increase, realize infinitely the consciousness and the power that is in it, to have the delight of coming into manifestation, the delight of the form of being, the delight of the rhythm of consciousness, the delight of the play of force, and to aggrandize and perfect that delight by whatever means is possible, in whatever direction, through whatever idea of itself may be suggested to it by the existence, the conscious force, the delight active within its deepest being. So again, here he directly improves upon the idea of Satchit Ananda, so it's Satchit Shakti Ananda in a sense. And if there is any goal, any completeness towards which things tend, it can only be the completeness in the individual and in the whole which the individuals constitute of its self-existence, of its power and consciousness, and of its delight of being. But such completeness is not possible in the individual consciousness concentrated within the limits of the individual formation. Absolute completeness is not feasible in the finite because it is alien to the self-conception of the finite. Therefore, the only final goal possible is the emergence of the infinite consciousness in the individual. It is his recovery of the truth of himself by self-knowledge and by self-realization, the truth of the infinite in being, the infinite in consciousness, the infinite in delight, repossessed as his own self in reality, of which the finite is only a mask and an instrument for various expression. So the goal of evolution is that the individual should manifest the infinite. The top joins the bottom. What is massive in the universe unites in the particular. Microcosm and macrocosm merge and are one without obliterating each other. Both recognize and are recognized as aspects of the Supreme Being. So, note again, the final goal is possible in the emergence of the infinite consciousness in the individual. It is his recovery of the truth of himself by self-knowledge and by self-realization. There's the key. Perfection turns on inner awareness, becoming complete. When you don't kind of know yourself, but you fully know yourself, you know that from which you come, then perfection is realizable, can be actualized. This idea that the finite is only a mask. Remember how this essay began with the notion that the Creator is manifesting a play for the delight of the play, and dons a mask, the finite, the individual, wears this mask, and we have to peer behind the mask and discover who that being is, because the mask disguises the player. If we only believe the mask, we don't know the inner being, do we? We don't know who is behind it. So there's a sense here that our participation in the universe is in a grand drama. Oh, it's real. And it's painful. And we feel exhilarated sometimes. But the game is for real. The stakes are high. First, we unmask ourselves, no? We find out who we are behind the mask. And then we can discover that out there. And I know you may tire of me saying this, but this is redolent of stories that Sri Aurobindo told about his own spiritual growth, where in prison, in the Alipur jail, although he had already realized nirvana, the vacancy behind the universe, that unnameable reality behind what is gross, contactable by our senses. In that jail, he had the experience of a Godhead who dwelt in all forms, in all beings. And wherever he looked, he saw the face of the divine behind inanimate objects, behind the judge, in the being of the attorneys and of his fellow prisoners. Wherever he looked, he saw that same divinity as a person, wearing this as a mask and saying to him, ah, so you have discovered me, but didn't I want you to find me? So, let's continue. Thus, by the very nature of the world play, as it has been realized by Satchit Ananda in the vastness of his existence, extended in space and time, we have to conceive first of an involution and a self-absorption of conscious being into the density and infinite divisibility of substance. For otherwise, there can be no finite variation. Next, an emergence of the self-imprisoned force into formal being, living being, thinking being. And finally, a release of the formed thinking being into the free realization of itself as the one and the infinite at play in the world, and by the release of its recovery, and by the release, its recovery of the boundless existence, consciousness, bliss, that even now it is secretly, really, and eternally. This triple movement is the whole key of the world enigma. So how does the infinite light, how does that oneness collapse itself, densify itself into darkness, division, from what is immeasurable into what has form? So we have three grades, that mysterious action by which the infinite involves itself, that's the process of involution, in which it, in a sense, telescopes its being into the immensely disintegrated basis of the world. Then the emergence in form, growing in consciousness, finally into the release into its recovered self, into knowledge, into power, into delight. So the world is a manifestation moving always forwards and upwards. It is not moving aimlessly in a circle or wandering hither and yon from matter, if I may say so. Life emerges. And as his sentences tell us here, in this living form, thought emerges. And it will continue pushing forward until it recovers its own essential nature, which is Satchit-Ananda. It is. It is conscious of itself. And its experience of itself is full of delight, beyond the brim, spilling everywhere. It is so, he writes, that the ancient and eternal truth of Vedanta receives into itself and illumines, justifies, and shows us all the meaning of the modern and phenomenal truth of evolution in the universe. Now, when he says the truth of Vedanta, again, this is the Upanishadic Vedanta. This is not later the Advaita Vedanta, which regards the universe as illusory, as a cheat, as a lie, as a deception. This Vedanta sees the universe as a valid, full expression of the Supreme Consciousness. Brahman is all of this. Sarvam idam Brahma. And it is so only that this modern truth of evolution, which is the old truth of the universal developing itself successively in time, seen opaquely through the study of force and matter, can find its own full sense and justification by illuminating itself with the light of the ancient and eternal truth still preserved for us in the Vedantic scriptures. To this mutual self-discovery and self-illumination by the fusion of the old Eastern and the new Western knowledge, the thought of the world is already turning and continues to turn. This is true. There is a synthesis, more and more, of the wisdom of the East finding its own justification in science as it moves forward, in the fields of psychology, in the fields of physics, inner and outer, in other words. Again and again, we reaffirm these Vedantic truths, these early insights. Modern integralistic and synthetic perspectives are affirmed by this ancient Vedanta. Still, when we have found that all things are satchitananda, all has not yet been explained, we know the reality of the universe, we do not yet know the process by which that reality has turned itself into this phenomenon. We have the key of the riddle, we have still to find the lock in which it will turn. For this existence, conscious force, delight, does not work directly or with a sovereign irresponsibility, like a magician building up worlds and universes by the mere fiat of its word. We perceive a process. We are aware of a law. So indeed, he's looking for that method by which this immense consciousness installs reality in this limited, though large, universe. How does that happen? We perceive a process. We are aware of a law. And here is an early hint of what he will translate a little bit later as Ritta Chit, that which is truth of consciousness thrown into ordered, harmonious being. It is a law by which Satchitananda becomes the world and the individual. Well, it is true that this law, when we analyze it, he writes, seems to resolve itself into an equilibrium of the play of forces and a determination of that play into fixed lines of working by the accident of development and the habit of past realized energy. So in other words, it looks like there's a balance of forces operating in the universe, and things run along according to a fixed law that was begun somehow by accident. And linking this to past realized energy means that there's a chain of causation following itself out in the progression of the universe. But it may not have any order or any sense in it. Seems to resolve itself. So he continues to step beyond this law of determination, which is an external view of force, not an internal view, and writes, but this apparent and secondary truth is final to us only so long as we conceive of force solely. In other words, if we separate force out from true existence, from sat, then we can regard the world as it presents itself as force, as simply this transient, shapeless thing moving constantly. We don't know where it came from, where it's going. So that is a superficial view of the universe, but it's justified as long as you don't see the deeper reality. We don't reject those views, we just say that they are incomplete. When we perceive that force is a self-expression of existence, we are bound to perceive also that this line which force has taken corresponds to some self-truth of that existence, which governs and determines its constant curve and destination. So there is an inner view of force, not interview, an inner view that reveals the existent and our direction in the universe. And since consciousness is the nature of the original existence and the essence of its force, this truth must be a self-perception in conscious being, and this determination of the line taken by force must result from a power of self-directive knowledge inherent in consciousness, which enables it to guide its own force inevitably along the logical line of the original self-perception. So this infinite consciousness sees a truth, conceives of it. That conception establishes a line of development which is perfectly consonant with the truth of its own being, and so it rolls out into active play. And he says, it is then a self-determining power in universal consciousness, self-determining power. It is not something outside of this self which is establishing it. It is this one self. This is all that exists, no? It's the one self which sees truly and acts truly and so establishes a truth in the universe. A capacity, he continues, in self-awareness of infinite existence to perceive a certain truth in itself and direct its force of creation along the line of that truth which has presided over the cosmic manifestation. I think you want to mark that passage, whether with a pencil or with a good memory. So from the beginning, from sempiternity, from the launch of the cosmos, there is an overseeing awareness that governs, guides, directs, not simply conceives and acknowledges, but is intimately involved in the manifestation. But questions remain. But why, he writes, should we interpose any special power or faculty between the infinite consciousness itself and the result of its workings? Okay, so there's that infinite beyond, and here's the working of the universe. How do we go from there to here? We're saying that there must be some bridging consciousness or mechanism by which the infinite is translated into the finite. So it looks like he's going to finally bring in the topic of the title, the divine Maya. May not this self-awareness of the infinite range freely, creating forms which afterwards remain in place so long as there is not the fiat that bids them cease? Even as the old Semitic revelation tells us, God said, let there be light, and there was light. But when we say, God said, let there be light, we assume the act of a power of consciousness which determines light out of everything else that is not light. And when we say, and there was light, we presume a directing faculty, an active power corresponding to the original perceptive power which brings out the phenomenon and working out light according to the line of the original perception, prevents it from being overpowered by all the infinite possibilities that are other than itself. In other words, in this passage taken out of the Bible, there is implicit the same thing. There is a will and there is an overseeing. God manifests and God directs. Infinite consciousness, Sri Aurobindo writes, in its infinite action can produce only infinite results. To settle upon a fixed truth or order of truths and build a world in conformity with that which is fixed demands a selective faculty of knowledge commissioned to shape finite appearance out of infinite reality. And he's back to his argument here, that it doesn't make sense to pose that the infinite can become the finite, because infinite consciousness produces infinite results if it remains infinite. This is mathematics. And let's note again, Sri Aurobindo was an excellent mathematician, made high scores when he studied mathematics at Cambridge. So it is necessary that a selective knowledge builds and governs a settled world according to an inner law. Now, this power was known to the Vedic seers by the name of Maya. Back to our opening motto, correct? Maya meant for them the power of infinite consciousness to comprehend, contain in itself, and measure out, that is to say, to form, for form is delimitation. Name and shape out of the vast, illimitable truth of infinite existence. So, if reality, if Brahman, that which grows endlessly, is Satchit-Ananda, still, for it to come into manifestation, Maya is the agency through which name and shape, nama and rupa, from Indian philosophy, are brought into being out of that. Maya, as he says, measures out. In its oldest sense, it is not a cunning cheat, it is not that which deceives, it is that which apportions. Now, the universe, as large as it is a limited field for the play of the infinite being. The universe may be without definable limit, but the infinite is infinite. Let's continue. It is by Maya that static truth of essential being becomes ordered truth of active being. Or to put it in more metaphysical language, out of the supreme being in which all is all, without barrier of separative consciousness, emerges the phenomenal being in which all is in each, and each is in all, for the play of existence with existence. Consciousness with consciousness, force with force, delight with delight. He writes there, out of the supreme being. This goes back to the way he originally translated that first motto. Out of the supreme being emerges the phenomenal being, in which the all is in each and the each is in all. The play of oneness in a complex and deeply satisfying interchange. It is bliss to play like this. This play of all in each and each in all is concealed at first from us by the mental play or the illusion of mind, which persuades each that he is in all but not all in him, and that he is in all as a separated being, not as a being always inseparably one with the rest of existence. And so we're confused. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verses 4 and 5. In other words, we understand division from the mind, where there is only differentiation. We think there's a real wall between us and that. Same thing. Sama Brahma, same divine. Afterwards, we have to emerge from this error into the supramental play or the truth of Maya, where the each and the all coexist in the inseparable unity of the one truth and the multiple symbol. And multiple symbol. Because every form is symbolic of that. The lower, present, and deluding mental Maya has first to be embraced, then to be overcome. Remember the Isha Upanishad, verses 7 and 8. So, the argument from the previous chapter, God, the divine, subjects herself, himself, itself to division. No one else experiences that. No one is put through the torturous movement from the unconscious back to superconscious except for that. No one at any time ever suffers except for the divine. The divine at the center of our being accepts all the experience into itself. And only so can we bear it. Bliss would be illimitable. We'd be washed away. Suffering would be interminable. We couldn't stand it. The divine is there supporting us. For it is God's play with division and darkness and limitation, desire and strife and suffering, in which he subjects himself to the force that has come out of himself, and by her obscure suffers himself to be obscured. That other Maya concealed by this mental has to be overpassed, then embraced. Again, Isha Upanishad. For it is God's play of the infinities of existence, the splendors of knowledge, the glories of force mastered, and the ecstasies of love illimitable, where he emerges out of the hold of force, holds her instead, and fulfills in her illumined that for which she went out from him at the first. From the obscured to the illumined. From being compelled by nature to reversing that, and through an inner conversion, giving direction to nature. Nature, obscured, is redeemed, is enlightened, and we are perfected, having grown into full awareness of our true selfhood, when we have achieved this harmonious marriage with matter. I think that's a good place to pause for this week. And we'll finish the chapter next time. But before we go, I think I'm going to inflict upon you sublime poetry.
Oh, God.
From Savitri. This is relevant to what we were reading tonight, I think, and it's from Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, and this is the third canto, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. all nature was a conscious front of God. A wisdom worked in all, self-moved, self-sure. A plenitude of illimitable light, an authenticity of intuitive truth, a glory and passion of creative force. Infallible, leaping from eternity. The moment's thought inspired the passing act. A word, a laughter sprang from silence's breast. A rhythm of beauty in the calm of space. A knowledge in the fathomless heart of time. All turned to all without reserves recoil. A single ecstasy without a break. Love was a close and thrilled identity in the throbbing heart of all that luminous life. A universal vision that unites. A sympathy of nerve replying to nerve. Hearing that listens to thought's inner sound and follows the rhythmic meanings of the heart. A touch that needs not hands to feel, to clasp. Were there the native means of consciousness and heightened the intimacy of soul with soul. A grand orchestra of spiritual powers. A diapason of soul interchange, harmonized of oneness deep, immeasurable. In these new worlds projected, he became a portion of the universal gaze, a station of the all-inhabiting light, a ripple on a single sea of peace. His mind answered to countless communing minds. His words were syllables of the cosmos speech. His life a field of the vast cosmic stir. He felt the footsteps of a million wills moving in unison to a single goal, a stream ever newborn that never dies, caught in its thousandfold current's ravishing flow, with eddies of immortal sweetness thrilled. He bore, coiling through his members as they passed, calm movements of interminable delight. The bliss of a myriad myriads who are one. Book 3, Canto 3. So, if there are any questions, perhaps you can send them to me by email. I think this is a perfect moment for meditation. Namaste. I salute the divine in you. Jai Ma.